From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Key Senate races keep Republican hopes alive. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. With less than a month till Election Day, Republicans might well take over the Congress, and Democrats are by no means certain of holding on to the Senate. Today we'll look at Wisconsin, where the Senate's most liberal member is no longer counting on re-election, West Virginia, which hasn't elected a Republican to the Senate since 1958, and Connecticut, where a popular attorney general is having trouble with a woman who made her name with professional wrestling. We'll hear about jobs and the economy, the president's unpopularity, anti-incumbent sentiment, and a pink marble driveway in Florida. On Reporter's Notebook later on, the U.S. Supreme Court reopens today, the first time in history, with three women justices. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. In states they were counting on to maintain control of the Senate, Democrats are facing unexpected challenges. We'll hear what's typical and what's not about Wisconsin, Connecticut, and West Virginia, including some choice TV commercials. On Reporter's Notebook, does grief at a soldier's funeral present an exception to the guarantee of free speech? Can Arizona regulate immigration? We'll hear about major cases before the new session of the U.S. Supreme Court. First, this news update. The State Department is warning Americans who live or travel in Europe to be on the alert. Japan and Sweden have now introduced similar advisories. Britain has warned its travelers against France and Germany. It's not entirely clear, though, what all these warnings mean. Siobhan Gorman is intelligence reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and thanks very much for being on our program again.
Great to be with you.
How much do we know about what the intelligence people know who have led the State Department to issue these warnings?
Well, it's interesting, actually. The counterterrorism officials I was speaking with yesterday about this actually said that what is alarming them right now, more than what they do know, is actually what they don't know. So they are very aware that there are gaps in the intelligence that they have on what appears to be a European threat that may well be targeting sites in countries like the UK, Germany, and France, and may involve a commando-like attack that we saw in Mumbai in 2008. But they're still very cautious about saying anything definitive.
Well, so they're worried about what they don't know. What are they saying about what they do know?
Basically what I just described, and so that's why what you're seeing is a very broad-based warning for all of Europe, which is unusual, except for in the cases of warning about weather patterns and health and things that would generally cross borders.
Now, they're not telling people, however, to stay away.
No, they're not. What I think is causing some confusion among travelers, and in fact from reader email that I've gotten this morning, is Americans in particular saying, well, what is it that I'm supposed to do about this? And what State Department officials were saying yesterday was largely use common sense. If you see something that looks amiss, then see if you can, certainly get away from the area and report it to authorities. Some things were a little bit more specific, like with your luggage, try not to have anything on there that looks explicitly American. Don't do things or say things that kind of call attention to yourself as an American, because that may well make you a little bit more of a target in Europe.
Is Al-Qaeda thought to be the source of these threats?
Right now, that's the working assumption that intelligence officials have, that bin Laden and top Al-Qaeda leaders do have involvement in this particular plot.
And as we discussed before, that has a lot to do with the drone attacks in Pakistan.
Yes, indeed. And that's what we have actually seen this campaign continue, and it's hard to know for each individual drone attack whether it's really directly connected to this European plot. But what we certainly have seen is a rapid increase in the pace of it, and I was told that that's at least partially attributable to trying to disrupt this plot.
How worried are people in the travel business in Europe, particularly in France and Germany, about threats that might discourage people who have second thoughts about traveling to those countries?
Well, I think you're hearing some concerns. What it'll depend on is how long this alert sort of stays in force and how quickly you know, various authorities, both in Europe and the U.S. and elsewhere, can decide whether or not they have foiled this plot or what it really is. And so I think that if it drags on for quite some time, then it really could create a problem. But if it's something that they can wrap up in short order, then, you know, maybe the impact isn't as great.
How much do you know about Japan and Sweden? They don't seem to be people particularly, or nations rather, that are particularly antagonistic toward Al-Qaeda or vice versa. Are they just telling their people to stay away from places where there might be a lot of Americans?
No, I think what they're saying is that if there are these terrorist threats that are targeting European countries to the degree that they have citizens from their own country who are traveling to Europe and particularly some of the countries that have been singled out in the intelligence, that they should also take precautions. So I think it's basically trying not to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I've seen a lot of reports about travelers in Europe, particularly Americans, kind of shrugging at this, saying, you know, we're always careful, we look both ways, but they aren't going to really change their behavior much. Is there concern about people becoming skeptical when the alerts perhaps don't turn out turn into anything?
Well, there's always a concern, I think, about sort of this crying wolf phenomenon. And I know that yesterday, people I spoke with yesterday said that as they tried to figure out how to word this alert, what they were really trying to do was balance providing as much information as they could, which in this case they admitted wasn't necessarily all the details that they would hope, without unnecessarily panicking people. And it's a really tough balance to strike. It does seem like so far people aren't so panicked, so, you know, perhaps it was successful. But the question is then, are people taking it seriously?
All right. Very difficult, obviously, to issue an alert without telling people exactly what it is they're supposed to be on the alert for.
Exactly.
Again, Siobhan Gorman is intelligence reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and thank you very much again for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, key Senate races keep Republican hopes alive on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Three-term Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, a Democrat, of course, bucked his own party on bank bailouts and the troop surge in Afghanistan. He was the only vote against the Patriot Act, and he has his name on campaign finance reform. Democrats thought he was independent enough to survive this year's anti-incumbent, anti-Washington sentiment, but maybe not. Professor Thomas Holbrook chairs the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And, Professor, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Why is Russ Feingold in trouble?
Well, you know, he's swimming against the tide. I mean, he's just like every other Democrat who's in trouble right now. His biggest problem is that when people go into the voting booth, they're going to see the D next to his name. And right now, that's not a good place to be, especially if you look at his previous reelections. While he won fairly handily last time out, he still, I think, only got around 56% of the vote. Time before that, he just narrowly beat Mark Newman. So this is not a guy who whom one would normally think of as being safe no matter what. And in a year like this, where the tide's just running against people from his party, it's just tough swimming.
He's not like other Democrats, though. He really is much more liberal, and again, famously the most liberal senator in the entire body. Isn't Wisconsin a pretty liberal state?
Oh, you know, it's interesting. I've been here for 20 years, and when I moved here, I thought about Wisconsin in very progressive terms, thought it was a very progressive liberal state. And it might have been at one point, but it's pretty much smack dab right down the middle. You know, if you look at our state legislature, you look at our congressional delegation, the House delegation anyway. You know, in Democratic years, we may trend a little Democratic. In Republican years, we trend a little Republican. But we're pretty much right down the middle. There was a study out, CNN published a study several years ago that was looking at how typical states were, and Wisconsin was very typical, just right down the middle on all sorts of dimensions.
Well, let's hear one of the TV ads of his Republican opponent, Ron Johnson.
There are 100 members of the U.S. Senate. 57 of them, including Russ Feingold, are lawyers. That would be fine if we had a lawsuit to settle, but we have an economy to fix. There are zero manufacturers and one accountant. It's no wonder we're losing jobs and piling up debt. I'm not a politician. I'm an accountant and a manufacturer. I know how to balance a budget, and I do know how to create jobs. Now, that's something we could really use. I'm Ron Johnson, and I approve this message.
Back to Professor Holbrook at the University of Wisconsin. He's a plastics manufacturer, Ron Johnson, and that's about what he has going for him, it sounds like, in his ad.
Yeah, but you know what? That's sort of exactly what somebody like him should be saying right now. I'm not one of them. I'm not a politician. In particular, you know, I'm not a Democratic politician. If you look at his other ads, they're I guess I would describe them as fairly issueless. Other than, you know, generally sort of being against things that most of us are against, like the bad economy. They're pretty issueless. He's not running a really conservative right-wing Republican campaign. I think that would be much to Feingold's benefit if he was. He's running anti-establishment, time for change, strangely enough, given the change from 2 years ago. And, you know, Feingold as a an 18-year member of the Senate is kind of a sitting duck for that kind of campaign. Now, I should say it's all helped a lot by Johnson having a lot of his own money to spend and having a lot of support from outside groups a lot, too.
Okay, here's a way, or one of the ways, that Russ Feingold is responding.
Senator Feingold has always been on our side, fighting the insurance companies.
But Ron Johnson won't even get in the ring for us.
Russ fought to stop insurance companies from denying Wisconsin children health care due to pre-existing conditions.
Mr. Johnson would put insurance companies back in control,
letting them raise premiums and increase our costs whenever they want.
Ron Johnson, hands off my health care.
Hands off my health care.
I'm Russ Feingold, and I approve this message because you deserve a senator who's on your side.
So, Thomas Holbrook, back to you. Pretty unusual for a Democrat at this point to be saying in a TV commercial he was for health care reform.
Right. Yeah, and I kind of get the point of the ad, but I do kind of wonder, you know, whether people are right or wrong, you know, to sort of be mad at the Democrats over health care. It's an interesting choice for an ad. I think it is good in that it sort of starts to paint the picture of Ron Johnson not sort of being there for you, not standing up for you.
What evidence is there for that? Does he have some sort of special association with the insurance companies?
Not that I'm aware of. I think other than that he's generally sort of anti-regulation, conservative businessman. I'm not aware of any special connection there.
And because of his image as the campaign finance reformer, it's hard for Russ Feingold to really do a knockdown negative ad if it would be possible in this case to do it in the first place.
Yeah, it would kind of be sort of giving up one of his own best weapons, which is, you know, his sort of reputation as a squeaky clean guy, a fair fighter, you know, not your typical politician. And in fact, early in the campaign, there were a couple of ads that were much more negative than the one we just heard, Feingold ads, that is.
Uh-huh.
And the Johnson campaign's response was essentially to just show part of that ad and say, look, Russ Feingold, he's just like all the other politicians. So he's really kind of in a corner. He can't come right out and swinging. Throwing a lot of mud, because that's just not sort of who he is, and it would be sort of counter to his own reputation.
Professor Tom Holbrook, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Peter Walston is a national political correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. And, Peter, it's good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be with you.
Here was a Democrat that they at least thought would have a chance of holding on to his seat. He seems, according to the polls, to be pretty far behind at the moment. How much trouble are the Democrats in right now when it comes to holding on to the Senate?
Well, I think that they're in trouble. We can't say yet that they're going to lose the Senate, but it's going to be a lot closer than Democrats thought a few months ago, and certainly a year ago, and when some thought that Democrats might even be able to expand their majority It's just become a real dogfight in a lot of these states. I mean, Wisconsin's a perfect example. The professor's right. Wisconsin is now very much a battleground state. It was that way. It's been that way in presidential campaigns the last couple of cycles. It could be that way again in 2012. And Feingold has a reputation for being independent, but also being very, very liberal. And it's not clear that that works in this environment.
When Republicans chose their nominees in Maryland and in Nevada, and they seem to be Tea Party types who might be too extreme, even for people who are really angry at Washington, the Democrats took heart. What's happened since?
Well, everybody's angry at Washington now, who's running for office. That's why it's unusual to hear Senator Feingold advertising on the health care issue. You're right. That is an unusual attack this year. So you have a lot of Democrats in the House and Senate, House and Senate races alike, who are campaigning against Washington, campaigning against President Obama and so forth, and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid. Everybody wants to prove that they're angrier than the other guy. But the other thing that's going on is Democrats are fighting back by trying to go negative in any way they can against these their Republican opponents, especially the Tea Party candidates.
I want to read from an interview in Rolling Stone magazine that the president did. He apparently gave the interview and then walked out the door and then came suddenly back. And said some of the following things. It is inexcusable for any Democrat or progressive right now to stand on the sidelines in this midterm election. The choice is between a Republican Party that's moved to the right of George Bush, looking to lock in the same policies that got us into these disasters in the first place, versus the most successful administration in a generation in moving progressive agendas forward. Is that kind of thing Peter Walston designed? Well, it's obviously designed, but can it be successful in bringing out some of the people who famously voted for him in 2008, first-time voters particularly, who just might not come back again?
I don't know. I think that's one of the great questions of the campaign that none of us will know the answer to until the election, frankly. I mean, polls are showing that Democrats are closing that what everyone's been calling the enthusiasm gap in certain core groups. African Americans are getting a lot more interested in voting. Hispanics are getting a lot more interested in voting. Frankly, young voters, that hasn't happened yet. They're just not that engaged, not paying attention. It's not clear that that President Obama can get them ginned up. Now, we see one possible anomaly in California where a lot of young people are excited about the marijuana legalization initiative, Proposition 19.
So that might bring up younger people who are more likely to vote Democratic and be good for Barbara Boxer and Jerry Brown. And would certainly help, obviously, the Democrats to hold on to the Senate.
Well, if Barbara Boxer wins, that's one race that would be helpful. I mean, again, that's a perfect example. Who would have thought that California would be a battleground in the Senate? But it is.
The president in that interview, when he came back and repeated to the interviewer, really got angry. He said there's the idea that there's a lack of enthusiasm in the Democratic base, that people are sitting on their hands complaining, is just irresponsible. I haven't heard a president say things like that before under these circumstances.
It's not clear that's going to help motivate voters when it sounds like he's berating them. There's been similar language from Vice President Biden as well. So if this is the strategy, I'm not sure that's going to work.
Peter Walston, again, a national political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Let's take a look at another state in Connecticut. Democrat Chris Dodd, whose father also served in the Senate, is retiring. Democratic nominee to succeed him is a very popular attorney general, Dick Blumenthal, and the Democrats cheered when the Republicans nominated Linda McMahon, CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment. Rick Green is a columnist with the Hartford Courant. And Rick, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Connecticut's kind of a staid state, I think a lot of people believe. And here comes this lady from the world of professional wrestling.
Well, and we're a blue state.
Very blue.
Five Democratic House members and an independent Democrat in the Senate and a regular old Democrat. And we voted strongly for Blumenthal. But you have a woman who has vowed to spend $50 million on her campaign, who is now just about dead even with Blumenthal, Dick Blumenthal, who's our attorney general, who's running for the open Senate seat.
Here's one of McMahon's ads. Let's listen to this.
So what do you think about Linda McMahon?
Well, I like what she's saying.
What about the wrestling stuff?
Not exactly my cup of tea.
Oh, it's a soap opera.
Really? Look, she tamed the traveling show world of professional wrestling, turned it into a global company, and created 500 jobs here in Connecticut.
All right, so? Think she can shake things up in Washington?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Linda McMahon, and I approve this message.
So back to Rick Green with the Hartford Courant. That's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. yeah, she has run a very sophisticated campaign. Her ads are really good. She has hired a lot of top political people in the state, paying them six-figure salaries. She's very personable. You know, she shows up at county fairs and is very easy to talk to. So she's sort of almost, when you meet her, the opposite of whatever stereotype you might have of world wrestling entertainment.
Let's hear how Blumenthal is responding, at least in this one particular ad.
I'm Dick Blumenthal. I approve this message.
More false attacks from Linda McMahon's $50 million campaign.
I'm sick.
I'm sick of her ads.
The truth is, Dick Blumenthal stopped nearly $1 billion in utility rate hikes and supports cutting taxes for the middle class. Linda McMahon just doesn't get it. She laid off 10% of her workforce but still took home $46 million a year.
We certainly don't need anybody in the Senate who's going to treat the people of Connecticut like that.
Linda McMahon, profits before people.
Rick Green, back to you. What are these false attacks?
You have Linda making a big deal out of a number of misstatements that Blumenthal has made over the years regarding his military service. There have been a few times during his 20 years as an attorney general where he has falsely stated that he served in Vietnam. In fact, while he was in the Marines, he served stateside. And she has made a huge deal out of Blumenthal, what she says, lying. And even today, this afternoon, she's out with a new ad where she flat out calls him a liar.
Wow.
And it's, you know, Blumenthal's arguing this is not, these are misstatements. You're picking out little things out of a, needles out of a haystack, but it's been very effective.
In her ad, we heard she created 500 jobs in Connecticut. In his ad, we heard that she laid off 10% of her workforce. Are both those things true?
Yes. she did lay off her workforce, and I think the other side of it is I think in the year where she laid off 10%, I think she took home nearly more than $40 million in compensation, Linda and her husband, Vince. So it's really gotten very negative here very fast. And really the surprising thing is to see a Republican doing so well here in a state that was so strongly for Blumenthal, for Obama, and has, we have no Republicans in Congress from this state.
Okay. And again, this is Rick Green with the Hartford Courant. We're going to take a little break, come back in a moment. I understand that those two candidates are going to be debating for the first time tonight. We'll be back in a moment. Later on our reporter's notebook, the U.S. Supreme Court is back in session today. We'll tell about that back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren, I'll be back with To the Point. We've looked at Wisconsin. We've looked at Connecticut, a couple of states where it was thought that the Democrats were going to do fine, and they seem to be having trouble with regard to the U.S. Senate, where they, of course, need to hold on to every seat in order to prevent the Republicans from getting into a very powerful position. Might not win the majority of senators, but they could certainly win enough to do a lot of damage to whatever the Democrats want to do, which, of course, they've already been doing. Peter Walson, back to you, the national political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We've heard about jobs. We've heard about laying off and sending overseas. We've heard about President Obama. We've heard a little bit about health care reform in the case of Russ Feingold. Are these states typical of the kinds of issues that are being kicked around? And is any one of them, or other states we're not talking about today, capable of changing very suddenly?
I think that that's pretty much what we're hearing around the country. I mean, the jobs issue is certainly the issue that voters report in polls and to be the biggest concern to them. But I think that, like you've heard with some of these ads in Wisconsin and in Connecticut, there's a lot of efforts, at least by the Democratic candidates, to try to find specific attacks on their Republican opponents. So Democrats in Connecticut have tried to go after Linda McMahon for her record at World Wrestling, both the layoffs that were mentioned, but also just the general record of violence and the nature of the programming there. That's obviously unique to Connecticut, and there you know, and you see business people, Republican candidates around the country who have are business people who and Democrats are digging into their past, trying to accuse some of them, Carly Fiorina in California, of outsourcing jobs, for instance.
So, with the exception of Feingold and health care reform, what the Democrats are trying to do is change the subject.
Pretty much. They are trying to change the subject and make it about their Republican opponents. And Democrats feel that the only way they can win a lot of these races is by making it a choice between the lesser of two evils.
So, Rick Green, back to you, our columnist with the Hartford Courant. We heard that spot for McMahon where the woman says, well, wrestling's not my cup of tea, but then they go on to say that she did a pretty good job as a business person.
Yeah.
How does she respond to the issue of the violence in the sport?
Linda has been largely able to neutralize a lot of the wrestling criticism by making the argument that it's just a scripted soap opera. And you'd be surprised with all the stories about steroids and, you know, scantily clad wrestlers. It really hasn't stuck. It has not been a real benefit for Blumenthal. Last week, when she said that she suggested that we ought to reconsider the minimum wage, that got a huge amount of attention. And I think the Blumenthal folks realized that, wow, this is the type of thing that people are paying attention to. Something like, should the minimum wage be lowered even? McMahon took a real hit on that.
So you just explained something I was wondering about, which was the reference to the soap opera in that spot. That's defensive on her part, saying all it is a soap opera and they're not really hurting each other.
That's right, despite some of the rather troubling storylines that you see that range from, making fun of disabled people to necrophilia to chairs being smashed over people's heads. The public really hasn't been that concerned yet about WWE. Most us reporters thought that there might be a little more traction there, but it hasn't been the case.
Is that because an awful lot of people, particularly in a state like Connecticut, probably don't watch wrestling, or that those who do would be in favor?
With all the YouTube clips floating around, they are now. I think for a lot of Connecticut, it's been discovering WWE. And she has successfully painted it as, even if you can believe it, family entertainment now. And it has not been the liability that you might think. I mean, she beat her Republican challenger, former member of the House of Representatives, Rob Simmons, in the primary. He constantly tried to make an issue of WWE. Didn't go anywhere.
Peter Wellston, back to you with the Wall Street Journal. The minimum wage, Social Security, those are issues that when Republicans raise them or suggest that there might be reductions of a kind, Democrats really seize on that. How often has that been happening?
Social Security, Democrats are raising that around the country. They're accusing Republicans of trying to privatize it, wanting to privatize it. They're attacking any Republican out there who's ever been open to the idea of private accounts or even raising the retirement age. Democrats are going after them on it. But what's interesting, actually, an interesting twist to the Social Security debate is that you have now Republicans accusing Democrats of wanting to destroy Medicare, and they're seizing on the provision of the new health law that did put through some cuts to certain Medicare programs. And Republicans are now turning that on Democrats and accusing Democrats of cutting Medicare. So it's a very interesting fight for the senior vote, which does matter in a lot of states, including Connecticut, Florida, and Ohio. where that can matter, and polls are showing that that is making a difference.
Do we still hear about death panels, or has that gone away?
I haven't heard about death panels in a while, but certainly this the Medicare issue is
sure.
now seems to be the number one issue used in ads.
Well, Peter Walston, national political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, it's always good to have you on our program, and thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Let us turn to West Virginia, where Democrat Robert Byrd died last year after serving in the U.S. Senate longer than anyone else ever has. The governor, Joe Manchin, was picked by Democrats to replace him. Manchin won re-election as governor 22 months ago, did it easily, has the support of organized labor, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the National Rifle Association, but he's still in trouble. Professor Mary Beth Beller teaches political science at Marshall University in West Virginia. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
What's happening to Mr. Manchin?
Nothing that anyone, including the governor, ever anticipated. Looking at this, I think it's very interesting because West Virginia, for the past three presidential elections, has gone Republican. In the primary election, West Virginia overwhelmingly went for Clinton rather than Obama, and then, of course, McCain took the state in November. So Obama has not been popular here. And what's going on, I think, is that the voters are really giving a referendum on President Obama because of things you just alluded to. Governor Manchin is extraordinarily popular in this state. He won re-election with 70% of the vote. And West Virginia is a conservative state socially. It's fairly fiscally liberal. But when you look at big issues such as social issues of gun ownership and abortion, those things play very big here. And yet Governor Manchin has endorsements from West Virginians' Right to Life, the United Mine Workers, AFL-CIO, including the Chamber of Commerce, also an NRA, as you mentioned. All of the big contributors are lined up squarely behind Governor Manchin. And yet Racy, who does not have any of these large endorsements, is in a statistical tie with the governor.
Okay, let's hear a spot that comes from the Republican candidate, Racy.
We generate electricity through coal, but Joe Manchin passed a law that eliminates 25% of coal usage in our power plants. It's Obama's cap-and-trade bill, West Virginia style.
Joe Manchin should know better. Cutting coal usage will cost West Virginia jobs. Joe Manchin has thrown us under the bus. So imagine the damage he'll do in Washington with his friend, Barack Obama. I'm John Racy, and I approve of this message because I won't be a rubber stamp for Obama's cap-and-trade bill. I'll fight for you.
Okay, back to Professor Beller. All the things you mentioned are in that spot. But isn't that bill that Manchin signed, which was referred to as a cap-and-trade type bill, aren't the coal operators happy about that? Don't they say it's good for the coal industry?
And in fact, it would not have passed in this state if the coal industry did not want it to pass. Our legislature and governor work very hard with the coal industry in this state, largely because we do not have a diversified economy.
Yeah.
And no, the legislature and the governor are not passing anything that's going to hurt coal.
Well, is Governor Manchin coming back at Racy on that spot? Is he accusing him of misrepresenting it?
I have not seen any ads indicating that the governor is attacking Racy on that. The governor's ads generally do two things with respect to Racy. One, there's a big ad quoting Racy, talking about the fact that one of Racy's standard lines is that he made money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it. And John Racy's quoted that for years and years and years. So that's nothing new. But Manchin is talking about that. He's also talking about the fact that there's an ad in which Racy's quoted saying that, you know, he's not in business to employ people. He's in business to make money. And the governor is attacking him for that, also attacking Racy for raising health care premiums on some of his employees. So those are the kind of attack lines that Manchin's using.
Okay, here's a Manchin ad so our listeners can hear it.
John Racy's been attacking Joe Manchin's character. Joe Manchin always stands up for what he believes. But what does John Racy believe in? a 23% national sales tax on everything you buy, including food, gas, and everyday purchases, doing away with the minimum wage, and Racy's companies have repeatedly failed to pay workers' compensation. John Racy is not one of us.
I'm Joe Manchin. I approve this ad because I'll always do what's best for West Virginia.
Professor Beller, as quickly as you can, do the facts bear out the charges in that ad?
Yes, they largely do. That said, Racy's businesses, while they have had some issues with noncompliance, across the board have also been given good ratings. So, yes, those particular attacks are true, but they're not true across the board for all time on all of Racy's businesses.
You mentioned that John Racy inherited his wealth. It's my understanding that his wife and his daughter, or at least that has been suggested, don't even live in West Virginia. They're down in Florida where they have a pink marble driveway in their house. Has that actually become part of the campaign, the pink marble driveway?
It hasn't yet. I think it's going to. If you look at Politico today, Maggie Haberman has a big featured article where she's showing this beautiful pink driveway. In fact, in the article that appeared today, it does talk about the fact that Elizabeth Racy and their daughter are residents of Florida. And part of the evidence that they used in this is that the couple took a homeowner's exemption that's only eligible to residents of Florida in that state. And so Elizabeth Racy would have to be registered as a resident there in order for them to qualify for that homeowner's exemption.
So they're easy. They either live there or they're guilty of fraud, one or the other.
Well, I believe that Elizabeth Racy does live there. She's been back in the state, and she was active in the state for a while in 2008. But I think she does actually live there as a property owner, and John Racy himself resides in Morgantown largely.
Okay. Mary Beth Beller again at the Marshall University in West Virginia. We can't end this program without talking about Alaska. I don't know why. Is there something about Alaska this political season that just makes it terribly, terribly interesting? Becky Borer is a reporter with the AP in Juneau. And Becky, thanks a lot for being on our program today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about how things are going, particularly for Lisa Murkowski, another one, not a Democrat, obviously, but somebody who was supposed to win, got knocked out in the primary. Now she's trying to come back as a write-in.
She's acknowledged she's made mistakes during the primary. She, for one thing, she said that she didn't anticipate the impact that the Tea Party Express would have. And she sort of issued a preemptive strike last week, starting running ads, taking aim at the group, saying essentially, having people featured in the ad that say essentially, we won't be fooled again. Tea Party Express is back in the state today, unveiling a campaign of its own, including a new ad entitled Arrogant Lisa Murkowski, You Lost. So it's a lot of that back and forth, but she feels very energized, talking with her campaign. They're excited. The more that they hear things like she can't win, they feel emboldened. They're trying to bring in as broad a coalition of supporters as possible, and they're going to, it's a group that they need. They need to get independent voters on their side, and they need to educate people about the write-in process. But some polls have shown her holding her own, which again they're emboldened by.
Now she appears to be then running against the Republican who defeated her in the Republican primary as a write. She's a write-in candidate. The Democrats kind of fading away. Is that right?
Well, she's taken specific aim at Miller, but the Democrat is Scott McAdams, and he's been very determined not to slink into the background and just be the third wheel. His campaign reported raising about $650,000. They feel very good about their chances. They're running a number of ads, and they're not ceding anything at this point. But as far as Miller and Murkowski go, they're focusing on each other.
You said the Tea Party Express is back up there with ads for Joe Miller, the candidate that defeated Murkowski in the primary. The Tea Party Express is a part of that movement that a lot of people that are also in the movement don't like, isn't it? Because they use establishment techniques. They raise a lot of money. They're a bunch of political consultants, many of them from Sacramento, who are part of that establishment that a lot of Tea Party people don't like.
There are groups nationally. I think Tea Party Patriots is a group that sort of has distanced itself from Tea Party Express. In the state, though, there are, you know, there's the Anchorage Tea Party, which is it's a nascent group. The Tea Party movement, obviously, is nascent, and it's just sort of getting traction in Alaska. But they put out a call to supporters today to come out to the unveiling of the Tea Party Express campaign. Tea Party Express claims that it was asked to come up here by the grassroots in Alaska to help Miller, who they consider their candidate. And so while Murkowski talks about them being an outside group, an extremist group, you know, they say, you know, we're here to give voice to the people who said we want Joe Miller.
Murkowski is pretty conservative. How is Joe Miller, what kinds of things is he saying about the minimum wage and Social Security and issues of that kind? Is he going pretty far out?
Well, his critics call him extremist. He has said, you know, taken issue with that label. He says that his thinking is in line with a lot of Americans. You know, he's talking about scaling the powers of the federal government back to what's allowed within the Constitution. He supports, he does not support the federal minimum wage. He believes that that's an issue that should be settled with the states. On Social Security, he thinks that there should be options for Social Security with the Department of Education. He believes that that could be done away with greater power and greater control being given to the states to control their own destiny.
Okay, a lot obviously going on in Alaska. And again, Becky Borer is with the Associated Press up there. Let's finish this program by going back to the beginning with Thomas Holbrook, our professor and chair of political science at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Obviously, when it comes to the midterm elections, you can take national polls and talk about how things are going on a broad basis, but it's really state by state that these issues are decided, district by district in the case of the Congress. Where do you put things now? Do you think that the Democrats are more or less likely to hold on to the Senate? Let's start there.
Well, I think that if I were betting, which I'm not, I would...
Everybody always says that, if I were betting, but I'm not. go ahead.
I'd put money on them losing.
Wow.
Losing the Senate, at least. You know, I was looking at some numbers, and they've got to hang on to all of their really close seats, like Nevada, Washington, West Virginia. They've got to hang on to those small leads they have. And then, you know, they've also got, they're close in Illinois. They're going to lose a seat there. Oddly enough, in Missouri and Kentucky, they're actually still kind of close. There's some slight chance they could pick up seats there. But places like Wisconsin or just Arkansas is slipping away. There are some seats that they have to know they're going to lose, and they've got to win the ones that are close now, almost every one of them, if they want to hang on to the Senate. So it's tough sledding, I think.
Okay. Well, we will try to watch things as best we can between now and November. An awful lot of going on in a lot of different states. I want to thank all of our guests for being with us. Thomas Holbrook, starting with you at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Peter Walston earlier with us with the Wall Street Journal. Rick Green with the Hartford Courant. And Mary Beth Beller, a political science professor at Marshall University in West Virginia. Thank you all for being on our program today. During Elena Kagan's first term, the U.S. Supreme Court has some explosive cases on its agenda. In a moment, we'll hear what they're all about and how many Kagan will actually help decide on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
We're on only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The limits of free speech, the power of states to control immigration, regulations on cell phone contracts. Now, some of the issues coming up as this year's U.S. Supreme Court session begins. Adam Liptak covers the court for the New York Times. And Adam, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
How many of the cases, because she was Solicitor General and might have worked on them, has Elena Kagan recused herself from?
You can do the counting in slightly different ways because they consolidate cases, but one set of numbers that's pretty good is 25 out of 54, so just almost half.
Other solicitors general have been named to the court. Have they done the same thing?
Yes, and when Justice Thurgood Marshall, the last solicitor general to join the court as a justice, came on, the numbers were even higher.
Okay, so you have put together a list in the New York Times of the cases that you think are the, well, the 10 most interesting. You never know, of course, in these situations. It may turn out that one or another pops up, or that for some reason one of the ones you think will be interesting turns out not to be. But let's start with those. And first of all, those that have to do with free speech.
Well, there are two big ones, and both of them are very interesting, and both of them evoke strong feelings on both sides. The first is about funeral protests at military funerals. And here we're talking about a fringe church, the Westboro Baptist Church from Topeka, Kansas, which turns up at military funerals and carries really hateful signs like God loves IEDs, God hates fags. Their theory, such as it is that God is mad at the United States for its tolerance of homosexuality and therefore is killing its soldiers. So it's bringing this very hateful message to a very private, grief-stricken place. But there's a significant First Amendment issue here. Nobody disputes that it's possible for states and local governments to have a buffer zone around funerals so that nobody can protest, nobody can say anything content-neutral, time, place, and manner regulation. The question in this case is, can the father of this fallen Marine sue in court over intentional infliction of emotional distress and ask a jury to decide whether this speech is outside the bounds of First Amendment protection? And that idea of letting juries decide what speech to punish troubles at least some First Amendment advocates. The father won $11 million at trial. The appeals court threw the verdict out on First Amendment grounds. And now it'll be very interesting to see what the Supreme Court does.
Is that one that Delaney Kagan can vote on?
Yes, she's in that case, and she's also in a second First Amendment case, this one coming from California, about the constitutionality of a law there that would impose $1,000 fines on stores that sell violent video games to minors. That's a law that's been struck down by the lower courts. Similar laws have been struck down around the country. The court has never allowed states to regulate violent materials the way it allows states to violate to regulate sexual materials, but it may be that this case, this new technology, and the fact that children are involved may lead the court to a different place.
What about immigration?
We've got two immigration-related cases. One of them from Arizona, which might actually help us predict how the recent Arizona law on police stops will be treated.
It's not the Arizona law, the one that everybody's talking about.
Right. This is called the baby version of the Arizona law. This one asks the question of whether Arizona can impose very harsh penalties on businesses that hire illegal immigrants. And here, a quite broad coalition of business groups, immigrants' rights groups, civil liberties groups, and the federal government say, no, Arizona can't have its own immigration policy in this area, has to follow federal law. But the federal law does make an exception for some kinds of state regulation. So that will be a case that's interesting in itself, but might also give us some hints about the next case down the line.
What about the death penalty?
There's nothing that goes to the core of the death penalty. There's no case asking questions like, what happens? You know, can juveniles or the mentally retarded be executed? There is the usual run of capital cases where a prisoner, for instance, is seeking access to DNA evidence, and the court will again look at the question of under what circumstances do you have the right to DNA evidence that might prove your innocence. There's an exonerated death row inmate who's trying to sue the district attorney of New Orleans for his 18 years in prison. So there are cases nibbling at the fringes of it, but there's no straight-ahead assault on the death penalty as there is in some terms.
Okay, and corporate rights?
You got at least two interesting corporate cases. One asks whether corporations have, quote, personal privacy rights for purposes of the Freedom of Information Law.
That involves AT&T.
Exactly right. AT&T has a couple cases in the court. And there, you know, that's a question of statutory interpretation. That particular statute does, under its definition of person, which is the root word of personal, say that corporations are persons for purposes of that statute, and yet it does resonate a little bit with the holding of Citizens United, which said corporations have some First Amendment rights.
And AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, what's that one about? I think a lot of people might be interested.
Well, that arises from the kind of form contract that you and I sign every time we buy a cell phone or rent a car, and sometimes in the fine print it says stuff, and what it says in the fine print of the contract at issue here is not only that I agree to arbitrate rather than go to court if I have a dispute. That's old news, and they can do that to us. The other question is, can they make us give up the right to have class-wide arbitration so that if I'm defrauded $3, and that's not an interesting sum of money to do anything about, you're probably going to eat that, but 10 million people are all of them defrauded of $3, can you go into some forum and say, all of us together are going to band together in a class action and we want our $30 million, please?
Okay, so we haven't been able to touch on them all, but we've gotten through a lot, and thank you for being so knowledgeable and able to describe them in so few words. When do the first arguments begin? When might the first decisions come out?
We had our first argument this morning, so Justice Kagan took the bench for the first time, and you might have decisions as soon as 6 weeks or 2 months from now.
That soon. No way of knowing which of these cases will come first, I guess, and there might be other cases that would come up during the term as well?
Yeah, I'd say they probably filled two-thirds of their docket. They'll probably take another 20 or 30 cases.
Okay. Once again, the Supreme Court back in business with, we should mention, three women serving on the court now for the first time in U.S. history, now that Elena Kagan is there. And again, however, she has recused herself from 25 of the 54 cases. Adam Liptak, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Carmen Radziner and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/To The Point. Check us out on Facebook. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.